Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the founder of the modern theosophical movement, spoke a great deal about her teachers that she called masters, but only in the sense of schoolmaster, not in the sense of our Lord and Master Jesus Christ. So masters as schoolmasters or teachers, adepts was a common word used, mahatma, which literally means great soul, and most commonly in the early days of the Theosophical movement, these two men and others, she spoke of many others, were called the brothers. So ever since she talked about these extraordinary individuals from about 1875, when she and a few others founded the Theosophical Society, to her death in 1891, people were curious about these men. Many people heard about them, but not too many saw them. Approximately 25 to 35 people report having seen them physically or psychically or both. But the great majority never saw them. So who were these brothers? Were they figments of HPB's rich imagination? Were they godlike creatures who were immortal, omniscient, omnipotent? Or were they just simply ordinary human beings like you and me? They come close to the last. So, in answer to a question about the nature of the adepts, one of them, by the name, pen name of Kutumi, often referred to as KH, the other one associated with him who was very instrumental in inspiring what became the Theosophical Society, was named Moria, often referred to as M. Those two names are pen names. They never give their real names out. But we have those names and they've been called by those names ever since. K.H. wrote in answer to a question about the nature of an adept the following. An adept, the highest as the lowest, is one only during the exercise of his occult powers. Whenever these powers are needed, the sovereign will unlocks the door to the inner man, the adept, who can emerge and act freely. The smallest exercise of occult powers requires an effort. We may compare it to the inner muscular effort of an athlete preparing to use his physical strength. As no athlete is likely to be always amusing himself at swelling his veins in anticipation of having to lift a weight, so no adept can be supposed to keep his will in constant tension and the inner man in full function when there is no immediate need for it. When the inner man rests, the adept becomes an ordinary man. Well, maybe not too ordinary, but ordinary in the sense of working from brain consciousness like you and me. Limited to his physical senses and the functions of his physical brain. Habit sharpens the intuitions of the latter, yet is unable to make them super sensuous. The inner adept is ever ready, ever on the alert, and that suffices for our purposes. At moments of rest, then, his faculties are at rest also. When I sit at my meals, some people think they never eat. When I sit at my meals, or when I am dressing, reading, or otherwise occupied, I am not thinking even of those near me. And Jwal Kul, who I will mention later in the talk, was one of his students, a high chela, a highly developed chela, but not yet an adept, lived nearby, and he says, and Jwal Kul can easily break his nose to blood by running in the dark against a beam, as he did the other night. And I remained placidly ignorant of the fact, because, and then he adds, I was not thinking of him. Implying that if he had been thinking of him, he would have been in rapport with him and would have picked up the fact that he ran his nose to blood. But otherwise, he was totally oblivious to it. From the aforesaid, you may well infer that an adept is an ordinary mortal at all the moments of his daily life, except those when the inner man is acting. KH, when writing, is not an adept. So the Mahatma letters are not really written by Mahatmas, in one sense. A non-adept is fallible. Therefore, KH may very easily commit mistakes. KH goes on to say that likely mistakes would include, quote, mistakes of punctuation that will often change entirely the whole sense of a sentence. That was Dora Kunz's chief ability, I think. She could twist words around like nobody, those of us who knew her. I loved her mixed metaphors. She used to say, well, that's the acid pudding. So he can make idiomatic mistakes, very likely, especially when writing as hurriedly as I do, mistakes arising from occasional confusions of terms that I had to learn from you, Mr. Sinnott. He was writing to Mr. Sinnott. Because the adept would describe something and say, you know, I can't give you, no sense giving you Sanskrit words that no one will understand. What do you, make up some English word. So we got stuck with one of the most dreadful ones, root races. Has nothing to do with race, but we're stuck with it. It means stages of human development, not race, as we understand the word race. So that was what KH had to say about the nature of an adept. Now, Blavatsky's first encounter with these individuals was with one in particular. As a child, she was an extraordinarily gifted psychic, probably the greatest of modern times, and only those who think psychism is absolutely impossible will deny it. She psychically saw this very tall Indian man, Maurya, actually, and he is 6'6" or 7" tall, according to what people reported, which was not too uncommon among the Indians of his ilk, his tribe, or whatever one calls it. And she saw this turbaned man, and she felt he was her protector. She doesn't say too much else about it, except when she learned very early in her life as a young woman, a child even, to learn to ride horses. And she was a great horsewoman. She was good at it. But she fell off a horse one time, her foot caught in a stirrup, and she would have been killed. She felt an arm lift her up and hold her until she could get back on the horse to safety. And she felt that it was him. Now, that's not going to convince anyone, not even me. I am bordering on a cynic sometimes. I call myself a doubting Thomas who has to put my finger in all five wounds before I believe one will not do. But then in 1851, as a young woman in her early 20s, she was in London at the time of the Great Exposition, and the Great Exposition was like a world's fair. So people from all over the world were there, and of course, all the colonies, Britain, you know, had colonies all around the world. It was the sun never sets on the British Empire, and Gandhi told us why. He said the reason the sun never sets on the British Empire is because God is afraid of what they'll do in the dark. I've told that to my English friends. They do appreciate it. But she was there in 1851 at the time of the Great Exposition. And in the Nepal delegation parading by, she saw Maurya, her protector. She didn't maybe know his name then, I don't know. Probably not. Saw him. Now, she was a Russian woman, and we don't want to stereotype anyone, but cultures do have certain identifying features, don't they? The English with the understatement and the stiff upper lip. They have the same emotions as the Italian, you know. To give an example of the English, there's a man comes home early one day in midday and finds his wife in bed with some other man. And his man's clothes they're folded neatly on the night table with an umbrella over. He goes over to the table, picks up the umbrella, snaps it over his knee and says, "I hope that it rains all day." This would not be the reaction of an Italian man. Russian people tend to be strongly emotional. And Blavatsky was, but also she was brilliant. She had an incredibly strong mind. So when she saw this protector, you can imagine the emotions that welled up in her. And she ran into the street to greet him. And he waved her back. And the next day in Hyde Park, which was so crowded with people there would hardly be a spot for a private conversation, she met him. And she says they talked about the mission he asked her to take. However, it is likely the conversation did not take place in Hyde Park, because in her diary, it was later discovered, she wrote, "The day of my dreams," or something, "I met my master and we spoke in Ramsgate, not Hyde Park." And then when the Countess Wachtmeister saw that, she said, "Well, why did you say Hyde Park, London, if you meant Ramsgate?" She said, "Ramsgate is a blind for London." I don't think so. It may have been a blind for Marsgate, which is adjacent to Ramsgate. And in Marsgate, there is a shell temple discovered, I think, in 1831, around there. Nobody knows who built it. It was a grotto. All the walls covered with shells, different symbols, flowers, animals, and something that looked like an altar. So we suspect that very likely the blind was to cover up Ramsgate, because probably the adepts and Blavatsky were not too anxious to have a bunch of tourists going into the shell temple that maybe had some atmosphere to it. They do now. It is open to tourists. And in any case, wherever she had the conversation, he basically said to her, "We've been looking around for quite a long time to find someone who might bring our ideas, our philosophy, into the West." At the time, the only Eastern manuscript that was really known, and then only among transcendentalists like Emerson, was the Bhagavad Gita. So she was told that they had selected her as the best available, and they said, "We know perfectly well your faults, and you've got plenty of them, but you're the best we can find." And he said, "If you take this task to bring our philosophy to the West, you will get nothing out of it personally. You won't get any money. People will turn on you. You'll be mocked by the religious authorities of the day, especially the Christians," who've come a long way by then, since then, by the way, and they have a much more open attitude than they did in the late 19th century. You will be attacked by the scientists of your day, because it was a highly materialistic science at the time. Friends will betray you. Your health isn't good and it's not going to get better. But if you take this mission, you can help lift some of the ignorance from humanity." And she accepted it, and it all came true. She didn't have enough money to pay for her own funeral when she died. She had lots of money for the society. She and Alcott, her colleague who was first president of the Theosophical Society, when they lived in New York, they had a case full of money for the society. They wouldn't touch it. They had to run coffee grounds through three times because they couldn't afford to buy fresh coffee. Friends turned on her. She was so upset sometimes. The adepts said they couldn't use her for weeks. Too emotional. So it all came true. Now, why was the society encouraged to be founded? The adepts did not found it. They did not run it. They inspired it. They wanted something to be formed, some institution to be formed. But it was up to Alcott and Blavatsky and others to do it. It was hands off with the organization as far as they were concerned. They said that K.H. once wrote, "The chiefs want a brotherhood of humanity, a real universal fraternity started, an institution which would make itself known throughout the world and arrest the attention of the highest minds." And it has, actually. Thomas Edison was a member. I could go through a whole list of people who were well-known and members of the society. So Blavatsky talked about especially those two who were willing to inspire what became the Theosophical Society, and they were willing to work with Blavatsky and others and help them to understand what was needed. But brotherhood was the central purpose all the time. There's a lot in the Mahatma letters about brotherhood. Sinnet wasn't too fond of that idea. K.H. said to him once, "You have ever talked about but just to put down the idea of a universal brotherhood." They wanted an elite school of occultism. And in one of the letters they said, "My brother, this will never do. The highest and the lowest must be brought into the movement." So there were other adepts. Blavatsky talks about others, some even Europeans. And several, as I said earlier, 25 to 35 people report having met these men or other adepts. Some of the claims are rather fantastic. They're put down as true. Me being the bit of a skeptic, I raise my eyebrows and pass that one on. But one of the most striking is Alcott. Henry Steele Alcott was, some of you won't know perhaps, was a colonel in the Civil War. He was an agriculturalist. One of his books on sorghum is still used in some universities. He was a lawyer. He was a newspaper man. He was so highly respected in this country that when Lincoln was assassinated, he was one of three men appointed to investigate the assassination of the president, and he found some co-conspirators. No one would ever say Alcott was dishonest. And he had a scientific mind. He was not a scientist, but he watched HPB so he wouldn't be tricked by her. There's some interesting examples, but we don't have time for all that. You can maybe ask me afterward about about a spirit picture. He writes this about seeing one of the adepts. It was when he and HPB were living in New York City at the southwest corner of 47th Street and 8th Avenue. It's still there. The building is still there. It's been called, the press called it the Lamasery because of its decor and, you know, the things they had in there. And he was there, and here's what he writes. "I was quietly reading, with all my attention centered on my book. Nothing in the evening's incidents had prepared me for seeing an adept in his astral body. I had not wished for it, tried to conjure it up in my fancy, nor in the least expected it. All at once, as I read, with my shoulder a little turned from the door, there came a gleam of something white in the right-hand corner of my right eye. I turned my head, dropped my book in astonishment, and saw towering above me in his great stature an Oriental clad in white garments and wearing a headcloth or turban of amber-striped fabric, hand-embroidered in yellow floss silk. Long raven hair hung from under his turban to the shoulders. His black beard parted vertically on the chin in the Rajput fashion, was twisted up at the ends and carried over the ears. His eyes were alive with soul fire, eyes which were at once benign and piercing in glance, the eyes of a mentor and a judge, but softened by the love of a father who gazes on his son needing counsel and guidance. He was so grand a man, so imbued with a majesty of moral strength, so luminously spiritual, so evidently above average humanity, that I felt abashed in his presence and bowed my head and bent my knees as one does before a god or a godlike personage. A hand was laid on my head. A sweet, though strong, voice bade me be seated. And when I raised my eyes, the presence was seated in the other chair beyond the table. Suddenly the thought came to my mind, what if this be but a hallucination?" There's the scientific part of him, see? Not going to be fooled. "I wish I had some tangible object to prove to me that he has really been here, something that I might handle after he's gone." Well, he was in rapport with him, so he did know what he was thinking, you see. Even I can do that once in a while, not very often, but I can do it. The master smiled kindly as if reading my thought, untwisted the feta, the turban, from his head, saluted me in farewell, and was gone. His chair was empty. I was alone with my emotions, not quite alone, though, for on the table lay the embroidered headcloth, a tangible and enduring proof that I had not been overlooked or psychically befooled, but had been face to face with one of the elder brothers of humanity, one of the masters of our dull pupil race. I have been blessed with meeting this master and others since then, but little profit is it to be reaped in repeating tales of experience of which the foregoing is a sufficient example. However others less fortunate may doubt, I know. There were many other encounters with masters. I mentioned several in the book. And there are some claims that maybe are a little dubious. One has to decide on his own. In the society, as I think you all know, there's absolute freedom of belief. You don't have to believe in master. You don't have to believe in karma. You don't have to believe in anything. You just have to agree that in universal brotherhood and the objects of the society with which I'm sure most of you are familiar. In 1919, a woman by the name of Alice Bailey, member of the Theosophical Society and also of the Esoteric School of Theosophy, believed that she was contacted telepathically by the master Joel Kuhl, whom, as I said earlier, K.H. considered a student, not a master. For about the next 30 years, she wrote books on her own, and she claimed that Joel Kuhl had dictated some books to her. Among the books that she claimed Joel Kuhl wrote, DK, sometimes called, was The Reappearance of the Christ, in which the book, allegedly Joel Kuhl, makes Christ into a great avatar or a great adept who reincarnates and who will return one day, much as the Christian church teaches that about the second coming of Christ. This was not the teaching of K.H., nor Blavatsky. They said there is a real Jesus, who they say is an adept, but not the Jesus of the New Testament, which K.H. calls a spiritual abstraction. They have nothing against many of the teachings of the New Testament. In fact, they even quote some of the New Testament verses when they agree with them, you know. And they have nothing against Christianity. They say they're neutral to it. But this idea of the Christ, according to K.H. and Blavatsky and the other adepts, K.H. wrote, the Christ of every preacher is the sixth principle of the human being, which is a term in theosophical philosophy called buddhi, B-U-D-D-H-I. It is that state of consciousness from which we get insights. It's that state of consciousness where we get the aha experience. That insight flashes on our mind and we know. One minute we don't know, and the next minute we know, and there's no measurable time between not knowing and knowing. It's a flash from buddhi, and that flash can be on a computer problem, a human relations problem, anything, not just so-called spiritual problems. So that is what the Christ is to the adept, not a reincarnating adept who will come back, as Mrs. Bailey taught and said that Joel Kuhl taught. So in that book, it seems almost as though Joel Kuhl is a mystical Christian rather than a Buddhist, see? So one can believe these things or not. You're absolutely free to believe whatever you wish, you see, but at least we should know some of the facts before we make our minds up as to what we're going to believe or not believe. In addition to that idea about the Christ, Mrs. Bailey contradicts the K.H. when she writes that initiates and even masters fully participate in sexual relations in marriage. In her book, Initiation, Human and Solar, She says that many individuals have become initiates while participating in marital relations. She adds that often masters marry and carry out all the duties of a husband and wife, but that their sexual relations are not driven by desire or passion. In direct contradiction to this, K.H. writes, "It is true that the married man cannot be an adept." Now, he's not against marriage or proper sexual relations, not in the least. But you see, the adepts claim that they have neutralized their karma. They have worked it out. And they know how we make more karma, and they ain't gonna do it. And if we have sexual relations, we make links, don't we, with individuals with whom we have the relations. This isn't bad. It isn't wrong. Human race would die out if this never happened, wouldn't it? But it creates personal karma, you see. So they don't do it. So there are others. I knew I'd have to cut and paste on this. There's lots of other examples. The I Am movement came in, and that was the first movement to put L, E-L, in the front of Moria's name, and K-A-H-N, Khan afterward, El Moria Khan. Sometimes I think they must have thought he was a Hispanic Jew. El Moria Khan. I mean, where did they get this? And they were the first group to say they were ascended masters. Ascended out of what? They say they're human beings. They didn't go anywhere. And then Mark Prophet founded the Summit Lighthouse, and later on his wife, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, founded the Church Universal and Triumphant. And they claim to receive messages from lots and lots of masters. And they believe they are ascended out of humanity and have become immortal. They are immortal. All this is nonsense. The adepts don't live for thousands of years. They may live for hundreds, because they know how to take care of themselves. We even have some people who live up to 120. So it's not hard to believe they could live to be 200 or 300 or 500 years old. But Blavatsky says not one of them is 1,000 years old. And when they take a new body, it's difficult for them to get the body under control. They say that. Now, Mr. Sinnott, A.P. Sinnott, was a prominent Englishman in India at the time of Blavatsky's living there in the 1880s, and he had seen some of the phenomena, a lot of the phenomena that was produced at Simla at his home. He had invited Alcott and Blavatsky to stay with him and his wife, and they did. And Blavatsky put on a real show of phenomena, rather spectacular. Sinnott also had a scientific mind. He didn't believe there was anything supernatural. He wanted to know how, what kind of natural law is behind the phenomena. He really wanted to know that. More than that, he wanted to be able to do it. So he said to H.P.B., Blavatsky, often called H.P.B., he said, "What if I wrote a letter to one of the brothers? Do you think they'd answer?" She said, "I don't know. Give me one, I'll see." And she hunted around to find one who would, and her own primary instructor, Moria, said, "No way am I going to do this," although later he did a little bit. Well, she found K.H., who said, "I'll do it," and he did. And the first letter Sinnott wrote, we don't have his letters, we just have the answers, you see, so it's like a one-way conversation, but we can assume what the questions were by the answers very often. Sinnott wanted to devise a test that would prove to materialistic science and everybody else that these occult powers existed. And he got a good one. He said, "How about you guys cause an issue of the London Times to be published in India on the day it's published in London?" Now, this was the 1880s. They did have the telegraph, but they couldn't telegraph the entire copy of the London Times. And Sinnott thought that'd be really a good test. That'll put the world to shame and make them realize these things are factual. And he was shocked when he got the answer. It begins this way. Precisely because the test of the London newspaper would close the mouths of the skeptics, it is unthinkable. And the results would be deplorable. They would prove very soon a trap. K.H. went on to explain that those who would regard the phenomena as valid would attribute it to the dark agencies that about two-thirds of humanity believed in and dreaded, Satan, evil, doers. They would, wouldn't they? See somebody doing something like that? It must be Satan. God wouldn't do anything like that. He did other pretty stupid things, but not that, you know. Sinnett said that half London would be converted. K.H. replied, if the people believed the thing true, they would kill you before you could make the round of Hyde Park. Remember, it was the 1880s, not 2014. If it were not believed true, the least that could happen would be the loss of your reputation and good name for propagating such ideas. True, if you think about it. And then people would require test after test and every subsequent phenomenon expected to be more marvelous than the preceding one. They would, wouldn't they? Yeah. Wouldn't we? Mm-hmm. I often say I wouldn't walk across the street to see somebody levitate. Because I say, why don't you just walk up the stairs? Why use all that energy to levitate? I can't resist some funny things, can I? In the bookshop where I used to manage in New York, the Quest bookshop for the Society, we had a wonderful guy who was of Irish extraction, and he had a great Irish sense of humor. And one woman was really a kind of a weirdo, and she came in one day, and she said she had learned to levitate. And when she left, my friend looked at me and said, just the beans. The master added, the higher and educated classes would go on disbelieving as ever, tearing you to shreds as before, and so long as science has anything to learn and a shadow of religious dogmatism lingers in the hearts of the multitudes, the world's prejudices have to be conquered step by step, not at a rush. The masters are very interested in molding the future. And one example of that is in, I think, letter number 5. I think it's the same in all the editions, that letter. And the master writes that a crisis in certain sense is upon us now and must be met. Russia is gradually amassing her forces for a future invasion of that country, Tibet, under the pretext of a Chinese war. If she does not succeed, it will be due to us. And herein, at least, we will deserve your gratitude. They never force anybody to do anything, but they do influence. They send a thought, a little bit of pressure, pointing the right direction, up to us whether we take it or not. Now, what the adepts taught. Science. The science of the day was materialistic in the extreme. They thought that matter consisted of little billiard ball atoms, hard stuff at the middle, could not be split. A physics professor at Harvard University discouraged his students from taking graduate work because there wasn't much else that could be found out. We now know it all. They were two steps from final wisdom. Just a few little things to tidy up. Others said that the world was now, quote, without mystery. At the same time, Blavatsky wrote, this was in the 1880s, the atom is elastic, ergo the atom is divisible, and must consist of particles or subatoms. She goes on. I don't want to read it all and take time from other things that are important. She then says, we're very close to the end of a particular cycle, and between this time and 1897, she died in 91, so she wrote this in the mid-80s, before 1897, there will be a large rent will be made in the veil of nature, and materialistic science will receive a death blow. Well, on December 28, 1895, the first blow to materialistic science was delivered by William Conrad Roentgen, maybe that's not quite how the name is pronounced, who accidentally discovered X-rays. That wasn't in the mind of materialistic science. One of his first X-rays photographed was of the bones of his wife's hand, and it goes on. A year later, Henri Becquerel, discovered radioactivity, a radiation that could be deflected by a magnetic field. To cap off these remarkable discoveries, while following up work of William Crookes on cathode rays, J.J. Thomson discovered the electron. The atom did consist of particles, as HPB had said. And there's more, it goes on. But the philosophical implications of the blowing apart of materialistic science has not been taken up by most scientists and certainly the likes of us. We still think in terms of matter. The so-called boss, the adepts don't have bosses, they just have those to whom they defer, those who they accept guidance from, those who they accept rules from, because they respect them as knowing more than they do, because there's a gradual learning process going on, you see. That fellow, whose title was the Maha Chohan, or the great leader, you might say, the doctrine we promulgate, being the only true one, must, supported by such evidence as we are preparing to give, become ultimately triumphant as every other truth. Yet it is absolutely necessary to inculcate it gradually, enforcing its theories, unimpeachable facts for those who know, with direct inferences deduced from and corroborated by the evidence furnished by modern exact science. And science has been the greatest ally, the hardest science of all, physics, has been the greatest ally of theosophical views. Now, they taught about karma as the fundamental law of the universe. I think in the simplistic terms we see so much in some of the New Age literature, it's as though, you know, if you scratch a cat in this life, you have to be scratched by a cat in the next, you know? I mean, if you hurt a cat, you have to be hurt by a cat. Hit on the right cheek, somebody has to hit you on the right cheek. It's not like that, folks. It's not like that at all. It's the fundamental law, and karma simply means action. And for every action, there's a reaction. Psychologically as well as physically. We know it pretty well physically, but they say psychologically as well. It's not simplistic. There are accidents. Things that happen to us that were not meant to happen to us. Things that happen to us that were not our fault, not our doing. That can happen. They say karma balances it out later in another life or later in this life. So it does eventually balance out. But 300 people in a plane crashing, I can't believe for one minute it's the karma of all 300 people to die on that day. Maybe it was just a pilot, so you better get the right plane. So that, they say, would be compensated for in a future life. They don't interfere with karmic consequences. They probably couldn't, really. But they certainly won't, except with their students called chelas, when it's not their fault. So if Blavatsky got herself into hot water, too bad for Blavatsky. She's going to have to suffer the consequences. But if it wasn't her fault, they would intervene. Okay, God and evil. They are not atheists, but they reject every anthropomorphic God. Voltaire once said, "God created man in his own image, and man has been repaying the compliment ever since." We make God into a gigantic human being who gets angry and jealous. He's terribly vindictive. So they say neither our philosophy nor ourselves believe in a God, least of all, one in whose pronoun necessitates a capital H. The idea of God is not an innate but an acquired notion. The God of the theologians is simply an imaginary power, a power which has never yet manifested itself. Our chief aim is to deliver humanity of this nightmare, to teach man virtue for its own sake, and to walk in life relying on himself instead of leaning on a theological crutch that for countless ages was the direct cause of nearly all human misery. Pantheistic we may be called, agnostic never. If you want to call the one life, he says, God, go ahead, but it will be a gigantic misnomer. Now, mainstream Christianity has come a long way from that day, you know. I mean, they now see heaven as a state of consciousness, which is a theosophical concept. In the 1800s, it was a literal geological place with gold streets. But it's not now in mainstream Christianity. I mean, a few of the what we call Bible thumpers still believe that, but not mainstream. Evil. They say it doesn't exist as a power. It is 100% due to human intelligence made vile by selfishness. The path. I got enough here to start my Auckland program, I think. I have to do a week in Auckland come April 5. Blavatsky was given a piece called The Golden Stairs by one of the adepts, probably Moria, because he was her chief teacher. And it gives a very quick outline of how we should live our lives if we're to follow the spiritual path. I'll just read a little bit of it. Behold the truth before you, a clean life, an open mind, a pure heart, an eager intellect, an unveiled spiritual perception, a brotherliness for one's co-disciple, a readiness to give and receive advice and instruction, and later on, a courageous endurance of personal injustice. Blavatsky didn't do very well with that one, nor do most of us. It's very hard when we're unjustly attacked, not easy when we're justly attacked. A brave declaration of principles, so not to lie down as a rug, stand up for what you believe in. A valiant defense of those who are unjustly attacked. Not an attack, a defense. And then a constant eye to the ideal of human progression and perfection, which the secret science depicts. These are the golden stairs, up the steps of which the learner may climb to the temple of divine wisdom. There are pitfalls on the path. One, surprisingly, is a strong belief system. Even, gasp, a theosophical one. Although Sinnott had a tendency to dogmatism and misconception about people, he was free of fixed ideas about religion and philosophy. K.H. writes, speaking of Sinnott and Hume, his colleague, their beliefs are no barrier to us, for they have none. They may have had influences around them, bad magnetic emanations, the result of drink, society, and promiscuous physical associations, resulting even from shaking hands with an impure man. But all this is physical and material impediments, which with a little effort we could counteract and even clear away without much detriment to ourselves. Not so with the magnetism and invisible results proceeding from erroneous and sincere beliefs. We would have to use more than ordinary exercise of power to drive them away. Then the greatest impediments to the spiritual path are selfishness, pride, and egoism. And are they ever insidious? They creep up on us unaware. Today, what about the masters? Personally, I'm convinced they still exist. And I'm convinced we can come into rapport with them, not know them personally, but to get some sense of their work and dedication for humanity. They say humanity has paramount claim on us. They do not work with individuals. They do not help individuals with their personal problems. Not anyone, not Blavatsky, not anybody. But they will work with people who are working along the lines that help humanity, even though you are totally unaware of it. You may be inspired to move in a certain direction because they see you're moving toward the right way, and they might give you a little push without your ever knowing the thought came from an adept. In The Secret Doctrine, I never would have believed it was there, but I asked Joy Mills once where this line came from, and she, in 10 seconds, told me. She's a walking encyclopedia of theosophy. She said, it's in The Secret Doctrine, just a minute, and she went and got it. Live the life necessary, and wisdom will come to you naturally. And the life is the golden stairs. But also through meditation, you can quiet the mind, and you can empty it of all thought of me. And then there comes a shift in consciousness. There's no me. There's no time. There's only eternity. This is not a belief to me, nor to thousands of people, some here. It's a reality, and it's transformative, and you never forget it. Now, I want to end, because I don't have time to do a lot of things I was going to do. Ask me about chelas and lay chelas if you want in the question period. We'll skip it now. I want to end by saying something about Dora Kunz, who was my friend for over 40 years. We liked each other. We made each other laugh. I believe she was acquainted personally with the Mahatmas, and I believe she was a chela, a student. And as I said before, I am a doubting Thomas. I need evidence, and I have evidence. Dora never, ever talked about things outside of her experience. She used to say, I'm talking from my experience, not from the books. She knew the books very well, but she didn't talk out of the books. She talked out of her experience. When she was out here as president, Rukmini Devi Arundel died, and it was alleged, I don't know whether true or not, that Rukmini Devi Arundel was a student of the adept Sechela. When she was told, this is hearsay, but it came, I think, accurately. When she was told she was in the lobby downstairs, Rukmini died, and she went, ah, I'm the last one. The last what? And then one day, and she lived on the first floor here in the last, what we call the president's room, which is not used by the president now or the last couple, but it was used by John Algio. One of the staff members was going by her room. She was alone, of course. Her husband had died years ago. And they were going by her room at about 3 in the morning, and they heard her in there saying, I am trying, I am trying. Try was used over and over and over again by the adepts. Try, try, try. We have one word for all aspirants, try. And there were some other things. She gave a talk in Philadelphia in, when was it? May 8, 1955. Someone transcribed it, and it fell into my hands a good 20 years ago. And I have since sent the whole talk to many people who are interested in and have some sense of the reality of the Mahatmas. I'm going to read parts of it to you. She describes the facial expressions of K.H. and Moria. That's not in the literature, folks. Nowhere in the literature. She says, the masters are interested in and their concern is for the whole of humanity. They are not necessarily only interested in us because we are members of the Theosophical Society. They are not interested in the past in one way. Their whole dedication is to the future. They are interested in the present, but they are mainly interested in shaping the future. If you read the Mahatma letters, you will notice this idea of shaping the future. When you know the masters, you cannot help but be devoted to them. But they do not want us to worship them. And the Theosophical Society was not meant to be a religious organization. I think that sometimes we put the masters on a pedestal and feel a little like worms below. Some think if they feel a tremendous sense of devotion to the masters, they can sit in a chair and do nothing, like being in a monastery. That is not enough. The Theosophical Society was not founded on that principle, and it will not fulfill its destiny if we unconsciously treat it like a church. The churches have a tremendous work to fulfill, uplifting the people, giving them that faith and bringing out their devotion. Devotion is a fine thing, but the masters require a very great deal more. We have to feel with the masters that sense of being colleagues, engaged in a great work together. As I said before, the more you know about the masters, you cannot help but have that feeling of love and reverence. But that is not why the Theosophical Society is in existence. Now, the masters are real. It is very often difficult for us to make the masters real because, first of all, very few of us study the literature. How many people have read the Mahatma letters? Or the letters from the Masters of the Wisdom? They are basic theosophy. We talk about wanting to serve the masters, but we do not bother to find out what the masters are saying. Few people seem to have read the books. We should go to these original sources. There are thousands of members of the Theosophical Society, but there are very few theosophists. It is very easy to sign a piece of paper and say you want to join the Theosophical Society and that you believe in brotherhood, but brotherhood is something we should live instead of talking about. The Theosophical Society is the testing ground for brotherhood. It is the place to let ourselves grow, to let ourselves understand that we are not to be dogmatic, to let ourselves learn to get along with one another, whether we like one another or not. Even the adepts say they like some people more than others, but they won't do personal things for anybody. You must be willing to have differences of opinion. You must be willing to stand the acid test even when you are called names. It is you who are being tested. If you walk out because one individual says something nasty to you, you are failing the test of brotherhood. That doesn't mean the other fellow is right. First thing to ask is, how do I have to change? Not how do I have to make that person change? If you could think of the personalities that you meet as the acid test of your own character, of your own theosophy, you would get a different point of view. When something comes up, ask yourself how you will take it, and ask yourself what it is about you that needs to be changed. The masters test us 100 times on that. If there were no Theosophical Society, then there wouldn't be this testing, and perhaps we would have it easier individually, but we'd not have the chance to grow as fast. How can I try to convey something of the experiencing of the masters? I shall try to give a brief description of what I think are some of the characteristics of the two masters that we always talk about, the Master K.H. and Maurya. As I said previously, there has never been a time in my life when the masters have not been real to me. And I shall try to describe them from my point of view. The Master Maurya was the master of HPB. If you read the Mahatma letters, you get some sense of his personality. As you know, he's an Indian. He is very tall, and he comes from a very princely family. I think that if you are in his presence, you have that sense that you are in the presence of someone who is every inch a king. That feeling really is true because he gives a sense of absolute integrity. That may sound like a strange word to use. What is meant by absolute integrity? All of us have masks. All of us think in terms of little things that are not true. If you are in the Master's presence for the moment, all of that gets wiped out. All of the little things which are not really true, which are not part of what we see as ourselves, are wiped out. If you are in his presence, you meet a person who is so absolutely in the center of his being, is so absolutely true, that you yourself get the sense of being thrown back into the absolute center of yourself. You get a sense even of the greatness and integrity of yourself. In his presence, you could not think of something childish or mean. Of course, there is also a tremendous sense of strength, and of a strength which enables you to carry something through to the end which you have started. It is a strength that has no ending. In the Master's letters, you will notice he is very economical with words, speaking of Maurya. There is also a complete economy in emotion, in movement, and in everything, even in his looks. He has a tremendously noble face, but whatever he feels is not reflected in it. It is a steady face. The facial muscles change very little because it is the face of a person who is completely at one with himself and who is cast in a solid granite mold of unity, integrity, and strength. I think that is a brief personification of the Master Maurya. The Master KH is totally different in many respects. Their two personalities could not be more different. Yet, they have a sense of tremendous devotion to one another, and as you will notice in the letters, they have been colleagues for so many lives. It is really a beautiful thing to notice how they work together. This is from someone who saw it. The Master KH is tall, but not as tall as the Master Maurya. He has a very noble face also. Whatever he feels shows. Pictures could never do him justice because his expression varies from moment to moment. He writes beautiful English in the Mahatma letters. He has a great feeling for music and the arts. He once asked Sinnett to play some Beethoven sonatas on his piano. I think that what the Master KH conveys is the feeling of love. You might think that if you were in the Master's presence, you would feel very small and shy. Perhaps the Master Maurya would give you a little of that feeling, but not the Master KH. You would have a sense of expanding consciousness, just as you would with the Master Maurya. But the Master KH has the great gift of making a person feel as though you had known him all your life. Don't you think that's a great gift of love? He is a person who is so much a personification of love that it draws from me all the love I am capable of. And so it draws from any person who comes into contact with him a sense of outgoing love. That sense of outgoing love is finally a sense of being yourself, a perfect being. We can think about the masters and we can meditate about them. In fact, we should think about them. Early in the 1900s, there was a letter to Mrs. Besson and said, the cant about masters has to be silently and firmly put down, because the thoughts coming to us interferes with our work. Well, that was taken a little too seriously, and they were never mentioned for many years after that. It's the personal thinking of them that's the problem, not the trying to be in rapport with their work for humanity that's a problem. That's what they'd like you to do, I think. And they really say more or less that. If you are in a quandary, don't necessarily ask them for help. Some people think they can petition them like Christian saints. But if you have dedicated your life to the masters and to the society and the work, remember that first. Then, when you are in a quandary, think of yourself in the aura of the master. After all, the master has immense aura. If you can develop this feeling of being within the master's aura, then you could get a sense of what the master's reaction would be. We would get into touch, but we would not have to ask for help. This is something all of us can try. Think of the master when you feel very upset about people. If you could put your mind into that state of in rapport of the perfect love and harmony, you would get some of the love and harmony within you. Even if the masters find it necessary to judge people, they see the truth. They are absolute realists. They work with people and don't judge in the ultimate sense because they are willing to work with anyone. When you love somebody correctly, you have to be willing to let them be perfectly free. That even applies to the lodge. We have to pull together, but we have to make an atmosphere in which people can grow and in which people are free. If you think there is not enough of that love in your life and in your expression, then think of the master when you are in a quandary. If you do not know what you should do, if you do not know if what you do is right, then think of the master Moria, and I think you will get an impression. Often we find it hard to judge what is right because many of us are pulled apart as far as the personality and the soul are concerned. If you have contact with the master, I think you will get a sense of knowing what is right. We are perfectly right to think of the masters in that way. Think of them as colleagues. Think how wonderful it is that we can be engaged in a work with people whom we can learn to understand if we study and if we work. I emphasize work. I think it is only by study and work that we come near the masters. If we are engaged in their work, then we are in the direct stream of their consciousness. So I suggest in your meditations, when you think of the masters, be very quiet and see if you can get in rapport with their love for humanity as a whole.
Tell the stories of the chulas that you promised.
The chulas. Lay chulas and not chulas.
Yeah. Apparently, when you join the Theosophical Society, the very act of joining seems to, in some ways, put you on probation. Also, if you're sincere about it, you really want to change yourself, you really want to live the life that's required, which is an altruistic life, your karma is quickened. What would ordinarily be your karma over a whole lifetime or several lifetimes will be concentrated into a short period. So if you mean business about this stuff, be prepared for more problems, not less problems. However, you'll be stronger to handle the problems. The Christians say God never gives you a cross too heavy to bear, and I think there's some truth in that. From the master's point of view, too. So there's lay chelaship, which is that period where you're on probation. The adept is aware of you, maybe even gives you a little help, you know, maybe you don't know consciously. But then there is the true chelaship, and at that point, you are linked to the adept in some, let's say, magnetic way, so that they are aware of what you're doing at all times, when they're not, when you're a lay chela, or us now. And before they link anyone to them, they want to make really sure that you're probably going to succeed. That's why they put you on probation for a year, 2 years, a month, whatever they think is needed. They think, ah, that person has some potential. Then they watch them in a traffic jam. Or they watch them when they have trouble with their family and start screaming and yelling and losing their cool. And they say, not yet. Not yet. So and Blavatsky was actually their direct agent. But in one place, they say she wasn't a chela. In another place, they say she was. But they definitely say she could not become an adept because she was too passionate. But they had high praise for Blavatsky, absolutely high praise.
This brings to mind the story of Damodar. Do you talk about him at all in your book?
No, I didn't really.
And do you have any comments about, because from what I've read about him, he was considered a chela of the masters.
Yes, he was. Didn't he vanish? Isn't he the one that vanished? Yeah, he went off to meet the adepts and was never seen again. Now, the adepts do say that they allow what they call the dugpas to get at you. That is the so-called brothers of the shadow. Individuals who have the ability of the adepts, but who are selfish, who do everything for themselves. When they see someone who is really moving in the right direction and might be a threat to them, they try to throw you off the track. And one of the first things they do is send discouragement. It's not worth it. There's only two members in the Theosophical Society branch that I'm in, and they're deadly dull, and I'm just going to quit. See? Of course, I'm never dull. It's just them that are dull. So anyway, they say, and one of the things that made me think of Damodar, I think he's the one that, he may have been the one who stepped on a rag. See, they say that on these treacherous trails in Tibet, the wrong step will send you off a precipice. And they said the Dugpas will put a rag there, filled with evil magnetism, and if you step on it, you lose your balance. That may have happened to Damodar. We don't know what happened to him.
Ed, let me ask you, the Mahatmas are much in the literature that's described as New Age literature these days, and their messages that seems to be something of a growth industry. Can you say something about the Mahatmas today in terms of the messages that people say they're receiving?
Yes, a lot of the so-called, first of all, the adepts say we never use mediums, never. That means we never channel through somebody. But most of these messages are channeled. And most of them don't sound much like K.H. or Moria or anything they teach. When they say humanity, 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 brotherhood, brotherhood, brotherhood is what we stand for. And yet all these, many of these messages are personal messages about love life, about getting jobs, about, they say they never do any of that. Now you can believe whatever you want, you know. I don't care what anybody believes as long as they don't try to make me believe it. And as long as they're not hurting anybody. I used to manage the Quest bookshop in New York and sold a lot of stuff which I thought was absurd, but nothing that I thought was harmful. So just judge by the content. Just because someone says it's a master who's written it, that doesn't mean it was a master who wrote it, does it? So judge the content. And also, when you're looking at the Mahatma letters, as Dora said, I didn't read that, but she says you'll get a lot of shocks. They say some things and you think, oh, wow, would an adept say that? They say some disparaging things about women. But remember, they chose a woman to represent them. And in another letter, they said that until women are no longer sex objects, we won't know what a woman really is. So they weren't against women. But what were the women like in the 19th century, in the 1980s? They were suppressed, weren't they? They couldn't do anything. They housewives. What were they going to do when they got together except gossip and knit? So no wonder it was, there weren't many of them who stood out. HPB did, and some others did too. And today it's very different, isn't it? You have to judge everything by the time in which it was written, not by today's standards.
There's a question online asking whether the lecture from Dora that you quoted from is available in print or online anywhere?
No. It's not. I have it on my computer, but I got it printed.
How did you get this letter from Dora?
Actually, it was from Lauren Wheeler, who was president of the NYTS at one point. And one night he got, I don't know where he got it, but he put it down on a table. And I picked it up, kind of in a synchronistic event, you know. And I have referred to it frequently. And, you know, people who are dedicated to the adepts, I've shared it with them. I will put it in my book, okay? So then it will be available as an appendix. I talk about Dora a little bit, and then I say her talk is an appendix number one. The appendix, the second appendix, is on meditation. So,
when was the talk given?
When was the talk given was the question. It was given in 1955 in Philadelphia on White Lotus Day, May 8. When Dora talked about the masters, you felt you were in their presence. The other thing about Dora that makes me think she was a student, she had a personality like HPB. When she was good, she was very, very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. And the adepts say they have to in some way impair their true chelas or agents. And when people were complaining about Blavatsky's tumultuous personality, her anger, she had a temper, and she would say sometimes the most outrageous things about people, they said, she cannot help it. She is a psychological cripple because we had to remove one of her principles. Now, don't ask me what that means. I haven't a clue. But in some way, they had to disable her, you see, psychologically, mainly so she wouldn't spill the beans about occult powers in the presence of people who were evil and who would use it wrongly to hurt humanity. A little bit like our government doesn't want to share nuclear energy secrets with, you know, rogue governments, because it's dangerous. And the occult power can be more dangerous than the atomic power.